Hello, I'm Dan Jurgen, Vice Chairman of IHS Market, and I want to welcome you to a CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market with Jim Fitterling, who is Chairman and CEO of Dow, which operates around the world in 40 countries, manufacturing 36,000 employees. And this is an opportunity to hear how one of the world's major companies is dealing both with COVID-19 on its operations and its markets, and also to look beyond COVID-19. Jim, let me welcome you to CERAWeek Conversation.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be with you, and thanks for taking the initiative to do this virtually.
Great. Well, we were picking up a conversation that we would have had at CERAWeek in Houston, but boy, has the world changed since then. And so maybe I might start by just asking you how COVID-19 has changed your operations at Dow, how you're doing things differently.
Well, we started obviously with operations in China, so we experienced in late January, early February, the beginning of this pandemic. We've gone to a virtual reality work from home situation for about 2/3 of our workforce. About 14,000 of our employees still go to the sites to badge in every day to make sure that our products can make it to our customers around the world. And things I'd say are working well. From a safety and security standpoint at the sites, we're obviously checking people when they come into the sites. We ask them questions about their health and where they've been, if they've been in contact with anyone. We ask them if we can take their temperature, so we have an idea of temperature scans in case there's any risk for the disease. We've really amped up sanitation and hygiene at the sites, even more so than normal. And PPE. And so in addition to the normal PPE we wear, we're encouraging people, because it helps them, I think, feel more comfortable if they wear a mask, even if it's not an N95 mask, but just a cloth mask to protect others from themselves. We're encouraging them to do those kinds of things. We don't serve food in the cafeterias anymore, so we don't encourage people to go to big group settings like that. They can pick up lunch, grab and go, or bring their own lunches in. And we try to do as much social distancing as we can, obviously follow CDC and WHO guidelines on social distancing to keep people at space. No big meetings. We're doing almost everything virtually. I'll have a leadership team meeting, an executive team meeting every morning for about 15 minutes on how we're doing. We have a leadership team meeting every week, and every week we get our top 3,000 people leaders together and just compare notes on what's going on.
So what percentage are your factories operating?
Our operating rate right now is about 80%. And I would say it's a tale of two worlds, Dan. If you're in consumable materials like food packaging, any kind of packaging, intermediates that go into cleaning chemicals, soaps and personal care items, sanitation materials, products that are going into manufacturing of garments, health and hygiene, masks like nonwoven plastics, et cetera, those rates are very high. In some cases, 100 or maybe a little bit north of that. When you're into durables, like things that go into the construction industry, automotive, durable goods like appliances, those numbers are down. They may be down as much as 20%. And I'd say in the intermediate would be architectural coatings for home painting and construction. Again, a mixed bag. If it's for contractor painting, that business is a little bit slow right now because not too many contractors are working. If it's for do-it-yourself, that business is actually pretty strong right now. So our coatings business is kind of stable right now. Kind of a normal first quarter that you would expect.
So have you had disruptions in your supply chains given the overall disruptions and shutdown in the economy? Can you move things pretty easily?
No, we're very fortunate that we haven't. We had some good advance notice, obviously having manufacturing operations in China. So we knew a little bit of what was coming when we saw what happened to the Chinese economy, so we could plan ahead. We've had good relationships with suppliers. We haven't been short any materials. And distribution logistics has actually been pretty good. March was a little bit, it took a lot of activity in March to keep things moving because with the amount of buying surge that we saw with people staying at home, retailers, grocery stores, et cetera, logistics were a little bit of a challenge, but we managed through that pretty well. And I'd say April, I think we're going to see that surge buying that we saw in March kind of come back to normal in the month of April and May. So a little bit, you can see a little bit of relief coming off on the distribution side.
So are your products going into the personal safety goods? You mentioned masks and so forth, and the garments that people wear in hospitals.
Some of our materials will go into making, for example, drapes and partitions that are in a hospital. They might go into disposable PPE that somebody on the front lines might wear. Medical packaging, obviously, because as these materials move, packaging moves. Sanitation materials. So a lot of wipes, disinfectant wipes and things are made out of non-woven polyolefin materials and not cloth. So a lot of that business has been very strong. And then also non-wovens that go into masks, and then other foams that go into masks to help fit the mask around the face of somebody, especially for a tight-fitting mask where you really want to make sure that there's no possibility for a viral contamination to get in.
I'm struck that, you know, people don't seem to understand that plastics are a very important part of safety and health. Are you struck by that?
Well, we've seen a big change in sentiment. I'd say probably the most dramatic is the grocery stores and the retailers saying, we don't want reusable bags coming into the stores. We'd rather issue you a clean, new, sanitary, disposable one-time bag. And I think what we've seen is obviously safety, health, hygiene, and security have come to the top of the list. I don't believe that some of the issues that we face on plastics longer term are going to go away. I do believe that this COVID pandemic is going to be with us for a little while, and then we'll figure out how to have therapeutics and a vaccine to treat it. And the plastics issues will still be there longer term. But I do think people are recognizing the value of chemicals and plastics both, and how they can be helpful in this fight. And basic things like sanitation, food containers, food packaging. I was struck just before this started, I was at a conference in the Bloomberg headquarters, and it was a conference where typically you would go in and there would be a breakfast buffet. And because of COVID, everything was individually packaged for that buffet in the morning. So if you wanted breakfast, everything was individually packaged to make sure that it was safe for everybody. And so I think it was an acknowledgement that they provide a real safety and security purpose in many applications.
I mean, up until COVID, it did seem that the role of plastics in safety and sanitation and health was just kind of not on the table. It wasn't part of the discussion. It is now.
I think it is. And I think it, people are appreciating things that were not getting very much airtime at that time. Now, I would tell you that I don't think it changes anything about our long-term strategy that we need to move to a circular economy and that we can't have plastic waste in the environment. So those things are still true. And I don't know anybody in my circle of friends and also leaders at other companies who believes anything differently. So we're still working long-term, like a circular economy, recycle, reuse, and repurpose of plastics is the right thing to do for the long term. None of us are going to back off of those issues. But in the short term, I think the value proposition has just been made a little bit clearer to the public.
So if we take, I mean, look beyond COVID-19 for a moment to the longer term, how do you grapple? Where's your thinking about dealing with the plastic waste issues? What are the essential elements that need to be done?
Well, I think the biggest thing is we have an infrastructure problem, and we have a couple of challenges. From an economics standpoint, it's cheaper today to make a virgin plastic material than it is to recycle anything and bring it back into the economy. So that isn't going to create a sustainable circular economy. And what you need is an infrastructure in place that encourages products to be brought back and recycled. I often use the example of a PET bottle like this drinking water bottle. If you live in a state like I do in Michigan, where you have a deposit law, and when you buy a soda pop bottle or a beverage bottle, there's a 10-cent deposit and you bring it back, you see very high recycle rates. The consumer brings it back, puts it in a reverse vending machine. They get their money back and they spend it at the store. A pretty high quality bale of recycled material goes back to the converters, and it can go right back into a bottle manufacturer or might go into PET fibers for fabrics. We need to be able to do that on more plastics and change the mindset of people that plastics are waste and back into the mindset of they can be reused. That requires infrastructure. Today, in most places, landfill is where a lot of that material would go. And landfill is relatively cheap, but landfill is not the right answer either. And if we go into places where there are no landfills and open dumps, then we end up with the plastic waste in the ocean issue that we're all trying to deal with, or in the rivers. So we need to create that infrastructure. And I think one of the things that in Europe and the United States, as well as in the developing world, is going to be to make that happen. In the developing world, we have a clean sheet of paper. So the bad thing about no infrastructure in the developing world is, you know, we've got a waste problem. But the good thing is we can start from scratch and build that infrastructure. In the U.S. and Europe, we're working against an existing infrastructure, and we've got to create other options like advanced recycling, chemical recycling, and other uses to upgrade that material.
And I guess the opportunity, as you say, in the developing world, is that's where the problem is the most urgent in terms of the amount of waste that just goes into rivers.
It is, and they've grown relatively quickly, and the quality of life has grown, and they're buying materials, and they don't have any place. The governments haven't had the wherewithal to build that infrastructure, so they don't have any place to put it. So they just dump it in an open dump. And sometimes that open dump is very close proximity to a river body of water. And as you know, monsoons, typhoons, other things come, and the floods will wash that out into the ocean. And we need to stop that. So we're all on board with stopping it. We're all on board with creating the circular economy. And I think for all the people who try to portray the industry as being evil, I think they're starting to see, because of this COVID situation, the yes. real value that the products bring into the society.
Well, it's just that you look at a hospital emergency room, how much of that hospital emergency room is plastics? Make the whole room work.
Well, I don't want to go into the hospital and not see that material, because that tells me that it's been hygienically packaged and it's sterile and it's safe. And it could be the hospital emergency room, or it could be something as simple as the Band-Aid that you buy to put on your finger. The fact of the matter is, all of that packaging serves a purpose, and that purpose is to keep you safe.
Speaking of safety, and of course you just mentioned Michigan, let me turn to another aspect of this, which is when this ends, how it ends. And I know you've been very engaged in trying to think through what are the steps and how to process it, and maybe talk about your experience in Michigan and more broadly how you're thinking about that.
Well, I think as we came into this and we came into the initial phase of the reaction that this is something that is very infectious and very transmittable, and we have to really shut things down. We had a lot of discussions about what is essential and what is non-essential. That was the case here in Michigan, the case in New York, United States, China, Germany, wherever. Now I think we have to get ourselves into the mindset of what is safe and how do we go back to the work sites in a way that is safe. We're going to be working in an environment for at least the rest of this year, maybe into next year, where we We don't yet have a vaccine. We may not have a therapeutic response, but we can't shut the economies down and put the world on hold for a year or 18 months while we develop that. And it's probably likely that we won't have testing available for every single individual in the world. So we have to think about what are the precautions we can take and bring people back to work in a way that is safe. PPE, social distancing, asking a few questions about contacts, if they've been into contact with anybody with the virus. The most simple thing, taking somebody's temperature. It's one of the indicators that we have, and temperature and how they feel in terms of respiratory condition. Sanitation, washing your hands, all these basic things we can do to make it safe to go back to work. And then I think we have to look at the risk level of various industries. So there's no reason, in my mind, there's no reason right now that somebody shouldn't be able to go out and do landscaping work or even do construction work, because in most of those sites, there's a lot of social distancing that goes on. If you're in a location where you're elbow to elbow with somebody manufacturing on an assembly line, you're going to have to take different precautions. And so I think we have to think about how different industries are going to go back and whether certain things go back at all. I mean, there's a lot of discussion now about office space. We've gone to, in America, we've gone to a lot of models where we're in open office space. A lot of questions being asked about, will that exist when we go back? What's social distancing look like in an open office platform? And do we need to be in a hurry to go back to office space when actually working virtually is working today? And some of my counterparts, and I included, think it's working pretty well. In some cases, we're closer to our teams because we're making that extra effort to have these virtual connections every day than we might have been if we were not in this situation.
So do you see a difference between going back to factories and going back to offices, driving in a car, public transportation?
Well, I think right now automotive business is slow. We need to get people back into dealerships. Dealerships are not a very concentrated place of people to create demand. But my guess is people are going to want to go back to driving before they're going to want to go back to flying. And we see that data already in China. Road traffic is kind of 80% of where it was back at the beginning of January. But air travel and long trips and rail travel are only about 40 to 50% of what they were. It's going to take time for people, I think, to feel comfortable going back into that space. If you ask me personally, I think I need to get people into the sites, the manufacturing sites, sooner than I need to get people back into the offices. And the reason I say that is we're trying to run with as few people, essential people, as we can on the sites. But I think to be more reliable and more safe and to take the stress level down on the people that are on the front lines, I need a few more people on the sites, and I'd like to be able to get more people back there sooner than necessarily in the offices.
How's your workforce? I mean, obviously, that's 36,000 people, yeah. 36,000 different people. But can you say something about what you find about the mood around the world? Is there younger folks?
I would say the morale is good. Dow people are pretty tough people. They have a very can-do spirit. They've always been that way. They know that our products are essential to a lot of customers and a lot of value chains. That customer connection has become much closer during this. The nature of our assets is they run best when they run 24/7. And so everybody likes to keep the plants up and running. It's the most safe and reliable way to run the asset. And so nobody wants to see them run down. And Dow people treat the company like owners, and they always have. And so that part is good. We've gone out to give a little bit of additional pay to our people that are having to report in that are on the front lines, those 14,000 keeping things running. And I think that's been well received. Our morale is good. We haven't had too many cases. I just want to knock on wood because we've had, I'd say globally, about 70 cases people, Dow employees and contractors, not a fatality that I know of. And probably they've all been in Europe and the United States, none so far in Asia, and none so far in Latin America.
None in China?
None. We didn't have any operations in Wuhan. And because the quarantining situation happened really on Chinese New Year, when a lot of people were traveling, anybody that we had who had gone back to Wuhan really stayed there until it was safe to leave. And we stayed work from home in China for about 4 weeks. And then we started up some operations. The demand had slowed down quite a bit. So then we started up operations in the end of February, beginning of March, and things were starting to return to normal in the month of March. We're not back to what I would say normal yet, but we're making that transition.
So you deal with a lot of different political jurisdictions, different political leaders. You've tried to make it, I think, the distinction between essential and non-essential is not necessarily the most useful construct. What do you say to political leaders who are, responding to a lot of uncertainty and a lot of pressure from a lot of directions as to how to think about the unwinding, bringing the economy back?
The virus is going to have a death toll that's assignable to the virus. Obviously, there are things that we can do to try to mitigate the impact. But the fact of the matter is, it's a virus, and we can't control everything about it and what happens. And I think what they need to get into is thinking about it from a risk standpoint. What are the things that are safe and relatively lower risk and safe to do, and that we can be doing right now, and try to get ourselves and our economies back to normal so that the economic situation doesn't become worse than the virus situation? And what are the things that can wait a little bit longer? And so we're trying to talk to them about, look, I'm manufacturing around the world and in Asia, and we're relatively safe and we can continue to operate. So there are a lot of other manufacturing organizations in the country and in the world that I think can continue to operate. If I can do that, why can't a construction site go back to work? Or why can't an infrastructure project like a highway be built? Or why can't somebody buy a can of paint to paint their house while they're working from home? Or buy some carpet to carpet their home? Now, if you're going to go into areas where you've got like a restaurant or areas where you're going to have a lot of people together, that's a different risk area. And so maybe that comes back later. And I think there you're seeing a pivot to online that's even more pronounced than what we'd seen before. So that's the kind of discussion that's going on. I think all the political leaders have the right intent, which is they want to minimize the impact to the public. But remember, the vast, vast majority of people aren't getting this disease, and the impact of the economy on the 90% is going to overwhelm, what's happening with the virus.
Did you see the economy? I mean, that is this question, what is our economy going to look like if we remain shut down for another 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months in the way we are now? I mean, what happens to small businesses?
Well, in the United States, I mean, small and medium enterprises make up 75% of the employment in our economy. And so most of the studies that are out there is that a self-employed worker or somebody that's working for a small and medium-sized enterprise, they may not have the capability to make it more than 2 months without a paycheck. We're putting them tremendously at risk. In the stimulus packages, obviously, if you've got a small business loan, you're going to see some stimulus money. If you're a taxpayer, you're going to see a check come in the mail. There are a lot of self-employed people who don't have anything yet in a stimulus package that's going to help them out. And we have to be thinking about the impact of that on the economy. So I would, from a Dow standpoint, I would prefer to keep running and to keep people employed and not have to lay them off and put that burden on the government as long as I can. And if we can do that, our people are very giving and charitable by nature, if they're doing well, they're going to help out in their communities, which is what they're doing today, to try to give back. But there are a lot of companies out there that don't have the size and the strength of a Dow, and we have to be concerned about them because they're an important part of our economy, too. We count on them to help keep things moving.
Let me ask you, just turning for a second, of course, to your feedstocks, hydrocarbons. What are these low prices meant for you as a company?
Yeah, this has been a tremendous time in terms of what's happened with the demand for oil at the same time as the supply has continued to be steadily increasing. What we've seen, obviously, is the drop in oil price has an impact on the drop in petrochemical prices. So, for example, naphtha cost for cracking is now down to below $200 a ton, maybe in the $150 to $200 a ton range. It was as high as $500 a ton not long ago. So the cost curve for ethylene has been flattened pretty dramatically between an ethane or a propane cracker and a naphtha cracker. Having said that, I would say on the demand side, ethylene derivatives are holding up very well. Plastics for packaging, intermediates like EO intermediates for cleaning chemicals are holding up well. Propylene has been hit harder. You see more of propylene showing up in the automotive sector. Things like the acrylics chain for paints and coatings construction hits that pretty hard. And then polyurethane insulations for construction and automotive, both those get hit pretty hard. So ethylene's holding up relatively better than propylene. We have a lot of flexibility in our slate. In the U.S. Gulf Coast, we can go anywhere from around 85% ethane. We can go to 70% propane cracking. We can go to 40% naphtha cracking. And so we have the ability to swing. And with these volatile times, we'll probably test that capability a lot. In Europe, we crack naphtha, but we can crack as much as 70% LPGs, and so that's favorable. In Asia, we're mostly cracking naphtha, and Kuwait is ethane, and obviously Saudi Arabia is a blend of both naphtha and ethane. So, you know, we've got a good footprint. We've got a diverse feedstock slate. We do a lot of physical and financial hedging. We take positions on the market. We try to look long term at what's going on and make sure that we're in the best position to keep running and stay competitive.
So, of course, we're only, a little 6 weeks, middle of April now into this crisis. We don't know the timing. You're already thinking about the other side of it. Have you had time at all to think about how the strategy and how the business has changed? Let me offer that as a final question to kind of look beyond COVID-19.
Well, we were pursuing a strategy of digitalizing Dow, and I'd say if anything, that just gets put on steroids now. That's been a big help in making this transition. I think longer term, we have to watch what happens in areas like automotive demand, aerospace, and those other demands to see if there's any structural change that happens longer term. But my sense is that for most of our businesses, 70% of our business is very consumer related. And I think the products that we're making are going to continue to last. We'll probably slow down some CapEx. There are some product lines where we don't need to expand right now, and we can do that expansion a year later or a year and a half later and still be ahead of demand when demand comes back. And in the near term, we're focusing our CapEx on keeping the plants running safely and reliably. That's the most important thing we could do. The other thing I would say is just cash and liquidity. We've done a lot through the spin to make sure we had a good balance sheet and a good cash position coming into this. A lot of people compare this to 2008-09. It's quite different than that time frame. 8-09 was a financial crisis. This is really a health crisis and a demand destruction issue. But we're financially in much better shape. So we've done a lot with debt, liquidity. We've got $11 billion of liquidity. We've got about $2.5 billion of cash on hand at the end of the year. We've moved all of our debt maturities out to the end of 2023 and into 2024. We've lowered our financial expense. We tapped the Eurobond market before this all happened at really good timing. So we've gotten ourselves in a good position. I think learning from 2008-09 and applying it here is going to pay off dividends for Dow in the long term.
But as you say, that there's no precedent for where we are today at any crisis. There's never been anything. Nobody had this in their plan.
You have to go back. I go back a long time. So it feels like the 1980s. It feels like 1987 from a financial market standpoint. It feels like 9/11 in terms of the way things shut down in the aerospace industry. It has some resemblance to 2008 and 2009, but it's different in scope and in scale, the fact that it's kind of this rolling epidemic that's moving around the world. That's very different than anything we've seen in the past.
And thank you for talking with us about this and putting this in context. I think we've known that obviously the plastics are, you talked before about essential, non-essential. One thing we do know is that plastics and what Dow does are essential as foundations and building blocks of our society. I think what you've underlined is the reality that's now so vivid to everybody, that it's also essential in terms of health, safety, security, and well-being in this crisis period. And that's a lesson to carry over for the future. So I want to thank you very much and wish you and everybody at Dow all the best in this extraordinary time. Thank you.
Stay safe and stay healthy, Dan. Thanks for having me.